Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Yokomis Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Mother's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your phone, your tablet, and online at LSJ.com.
This is Current State, and I'm Emmanuel Berry in for Mark Bayshore. Don't worry, he'll be back tomorrow. Today on the show, we're going to be looking at oil drilling in Jackson County, also business news with Angela Whitrock. But first, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation recently released a massive study that analyzes healthcare in counties across the country and ranks them based on health data. Bridge Magazine senior writer Ron French has been sifting through the study's data on Michigan counties and is here to discuss some of the more striking trends. Welcome back to the program once again, Ron French.
Glad to be here, Emmanuel.
So you've been looking at this giant study, and in particular looking at cases of healthcare in Michigan. What you wrote about last week about STDs two weeks ago you wrote about STDs. Talk a little bit about what you found about the trends with STDs in Michigan.
Well, thank you. There are huge disparities across the state in the rates of sexually transmitted disease. And once you start digging into the data, you start wondering why that would be. And the highest rates by a long shot are urban areas, and especially though in a strip that runs right along I-94 all the way across the state, all the way from Wayne County all the way over to Van Buren. And you think, well, what is going on there? Why would there be a different rate, that much of a different rate, in the areas along that one highway? So we tried to explore that and found some pretty fascinating reasons for that.
So what are the reasons? Why is it would seem like, or do people along highways just have more STDs? Like, what's going on here?
Right. Yeah. I mean, just someone looking at you think, well, gosh, there's different sexual behavior going on there, or more sexual behavior going on there along that strip. And when you talk to experts, you get the impression sexual behavior is pretty normal across the whole state. That's not going to vary that much. But what would be the difference? Well, we found that one thing that is likely to be happening there, in all those counties along I-94, every one of them have a Planned Parenthood. Now, why would that matter? Because when women go to Planned Parenthood for any sort of exams or tests, women are tested for STDs, and so people find out they have STDs. Now, see, this study is based on chlamydia, and the reason that's important is because chlamydia, in about half the cases, people don't even know they have it. There are no symptoms. They're just carriers, and so there would be no reason for you to go to a physician to check out a problem you're having. The only way you ever find out you have it and that you are spreading it is when you would go to a doctor for something else. Well, in counties that you have a Planned Parenthood, or for that matter, if you have a Planned Parenthood that draws in women from other counties to the centers for any sort of testing, mammograms, whatever, you're tested, you find out you have this. And frankly, what we found is we believe that probably the counties with the higher STD rates, probably that's a good thing, because people are finding out they
are
have
actually
this.
Being tested versus
and once they're tested, chlamydia is something that's easily fixed with some antibiotics, and so the concern may be in the counties that have the low rates, because perhaps people don't realize they have this concern, and it can be dangerous to women if they don't get it taken care of.
Now, STDs are just one of the many things that this study looked at. What are some of the other things that this study measured?
Overall, the study looked at both health factors and health outcomes, ranking counties across the state. And what was interesting and troubling in parts is seeing the disparity in those overall rankings. You found Leelanau County having great health their residents are very healthy. You find Washtenaw County has a very healthy residents. You find Wayne County, where Detroit is located, very bad. Why would that be? Especially when you look at like a Wayne and a Washtenaw, they're right next to each other. What could possibly be such a difference when you have counties that just abut each other? They both have great hospitals. Any physical specialist you could possibly imagine you can get to. Why would the health outcomes be so different between those two counties? And everyone we talk to says a lot of it has to do not with your doctors, but with your paycheck. There's so much depends on your health outcomes, on how much money you make or if you make any money at all.
Now, the study also found that Clinton County, which is it's just north of here, it's number 3 on the list in rankings, and 11 out of the top 20 are on lakefront property, and then Clinton County, smack dab in the middle of the state, is also up there with them. What's going on with Clinton County? Why are people so healthy there?
That's a good question. I think we should all move there. What do you think? what you find a lot of times is that the counties that are ranked pretty high the health of their residents, a lot of them have higher incomes. You look at Leelanau, it's also one of the absolute highest median incomes in the state. Washtenaw is the same way. When you have more money, you are more likely to have good health insurance. You are more likely to go into a doctor quickly when something is wrong, as opposed to waiting and then your problems become more severe. You're also more likely, if you have a chronic illness such as diabetes, to continue to take your medications on a regular basis because you can afford them, because you just give them your health card and it's taken care of. So I suspect what you're seeing there in Clinton and Livingston right there beside it, you have slightly higher income, median income there than you would in Ingham County here.
Now, what about Ingham County? Did anything interesting strike you about Ingham County in the findings?
Well, in this whole region, Ingham, Livingston, Eaton, Clinton, all of them do fairly well overall. Livingston and Eaton are all in the top quarter of health outcomes and health factors. Ingham's in the top half. But one thing struck us about Ingham County, they are almost dead last in a ranking for physical environment. And you think, why would that be? Well, it's broken down a little farther, and you find that Ingham County has one of the highest rates in the state for percentage of restaurants that are fast food restaurants, and one of the lowest rates in the state, I'm sorry, one of the highest rates in the state for number of people who do not have easy access to healthy foods. And that's measured by your distance to a grocery store. So those two factors alone, when you combine them, really indicate that people do not have access to decent food. They're eating more fast food. That affects your health, and overall, that you could end up dying earlier because you have so many fast food restaurants around you.
So it seems like there are so many kind of factors interwoven into this. So we're looking at income, race, gender, and you're talking about food systems also. What does this mean for policymakers when they're looking where to spend money to help with health? Where do they put the money?
That's a very interesting question, Emmanuel. I think that one thing you want to look at when you're looking at health outcomes and how to fix it, sometimes the easiest answer is not the right answer. It's not necessarily spending more money to have a few more doctors at the Detroit Medical Center. Okay, I'm sure they would need them. And there are certainly parts of the state that are underserved by physicians. But that's like giving an aspirin to someone with a headache. It does not solve the underlying problem here. The underlying problem are jobs. That more jobs, better jobs, jobs that provide health care, fix the health care problem. And going back even a step farther than that, how do you get better jobs? Education. You know, this may be a problem that we have to look at and say perhaps the solution to this is more early childhood education so that 30 years from now we have better health. It's an odd way to look at it, but it's all
tied
together.
Together.
Exactly.
Now, what? How does Medicaid kind of fit into this? What are experts talking about and saying about Medicaid expansion in Michigan? And how could that potentially be a short-term solution, perchance, or aid in this these disparities?
Sure, absolutely. There is a study that was put together by the Michigan League of Public Policy that looks at how many people would be helped with health care if Medicaid was expanded, and they also ranked it by county. And what was interesting, in part, is that many of the counties that are the poorest, that the people are in the worst health, also are the areas where the highest percentage of residents would get coverage if they had expanded Medicaid. So that's something that probably will be playing out in policy debates here in the next few months.
Now, this study, the Robert Wood Johnson report that they released, how does this compare to other studies on medical issues within the states and with counties? This is kind of a new great resource to use, or are there lots of other studies coming out of this ilk?
This is a great source for the public. It really is. If you go to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation website, Google in health county rankings, you can look at different states. You can look at county by county within Michigan, and you can compare your county to other counties to see how they rank different ways and get a sense for yourself, you know, what sort of problems your neighbors are facing. It's also good for policymakers to look at this and see what parts of the state are having struggles and what they can do about it.
Now you're working on another story based off of this information. What do you have on deck for Bridge?
Yes, tomorrow, Tuesday, we will have a third part in this series looking at some of this data from the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation. And we're going to look specifically at one part of the state, the northeast corner of the Lower Peninsula. It's an area with Oscoda County, Alpena, Alcona, Presque Isle, and Montmorency. Those are counties that don't get a lot of traffic through there, but they are as a region is the unhealthiest region in the state. And you look at why would that be? You know, it's pure Michigan view of everything being great up north.
You know,
and there's certainly away from pollution, all of this. But what you find is also the poorest part of the state as a region. And when I interviewed several physicians who work in that area, and they'll say that that a lot more of their people, their residents, just do not have insurance. And so they can't come in for treatment. And it's particularly true with chronic diseases, where people just know they have diabetes, but they won't take medications for it because it's a choice between diabetes medication or putting food on the table. And what are you going to do?
You're going to eat.
You're going to eat.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to reading your article tomorrow. Ron French is a senior writer for Bridge Magazine. He's been looking into the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's recently released health data on Michigan. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry, and in studio, as always on most Mondays, we have Angela Whitrock of MLive. She's going to give us a rundown of the local economy, business, and development news. Welcome. First time both of us talking in studio together. Welcome,
Angela. I
know.
Angela. It's a nice change.
Yeah.
Good to
you don't
see
have
you.
To look at Mark. No.
I have to say, I do adore Mark, but you are much more adorable.
Thank you. No. We love Mark. So a lot of different development news in particular, I think, going on, and also looking at budget season as always a painful season. So you actually had an article yesterday in MLive, and you were looking at increased fees for city services as a way to balance the Lansing budget. So what kind of fees are increasing, and how does this help the budget? Is it even plausible, I guess?
Well, the biggest the headlines so far have been made on the two largest fee increases, which would be shifting the burden from the general fund budget to city taxpayers via a fee on their power bills for streetlights and fire hydrants. But in a review of the proposed budget, we found that there are more than 130 fees included that are either new fees or will increase. This is everything from cemetery plots. If you want to be buried at Mount Hope Cemetery, that's going to cost you a lot more money than it used to, whether you're a resident or non-resident. If you get into a car accident and the fire trucks have to come and cut you out of your car, that used to be free. That's going to cost you a lot of money now. So, you know, pretty much everything, including parking tickets. I mean, it used to be, for a while, it was like $5 if you overstayed your meter. And if you went within 2 hours to pay it, $5. Now it's $7. Next, it will be $10. So everything is going up. And, you know, part of this is because the city has less money. I mean, property tax revenues are still falling. It's going to take a while for them to catch back up to the rate of, you know, because of Proposal A and these weird caps on everything. It's going to take a while for that revenue stream to rebound, even as we see home sales increasing and things like that. And the big chunk, really, and the mayor's office has been very vocal about this, is that the state has just gutted revenue sharing to cities. So Lansing has taken a cut every year since Bernero's been in office, and every year since, I think, about 2000. They've just, you know, the money that the state is supposed to be giving them is just not coming through. I mean, this is, you know, imagine your parents have promised to pay your rent through college. And every month they call you and say, well, I know your rent's $900, but we're going to give you $800. And then they call you the next month and say, well, I know it's $900, and we gave you $800, but now we're down to $700. That's sort of what's been happening to cities across the state. And they're, you know, all scrambling, looking for ways to fill that hole. You know, there's a promise made. It's money that city taxpayers pay in the expectation that their city will get it back, and they aren't. And these fees are the way to fill that gigantic hole that's left.
What has been the reaction to this so far? Do the council members seem, you know, okay with it, to go along with it, or is it kind of controversial?
You know, they're somewhat controversial, but the way that this council is set up and this city government is set up is, unless the council can mount a successful veto challenge, they can't do much more than, you know, beat their drums and rail against it. So even if they came out and said, we think this is too much, there's not anything they can do about it. Bernero's still got his veto power, and unless they can get six votes together, which right now with the current makeup is extraordinarily unlikely, they have no choice but to go along with it. You know, I think they recognize that this budget is a painful process, and it's a problem, and it's got to be balanced.
Now, moving on, another article was looking at how Snyder has been talking a lot about steering students into certain types of jobs, building students to fill the skills and the job sets that we need. And Rick Haglund had a very interesting piece that kind of said, well, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. John Engler, the governor, many years back, kind of at this point, had this whole plan about doing that, and it fell apart essentially, because the jobs that we were looking at 10 years ago don't exist anymore. Right. There's different jobs. I guess, what's your take on this article and on the situation, especially in light of all these, you know, people are about to graduate from college and everyone's kind of being told this is where you should go to make money. This is where jobs are. What's your take?
Well, I think, in this type of economy that we're in now, it's always been a pretty tenuous proposition to prepare people for the labor market by training them so specifically. I think, you know, when I was a student, there was lots of talk about, you know, maybe you should be an engineer, and then when you graduate, there are going to be all these fictitious engineering jobs. And, it's by the time that you train somebody so specifically, it's a crapshoot whether that job is going to be there. And I think that's what Rick's column really pointed out, is that maybe instead of saying, you know, we're going to need 300,000 teachers in the year 2025, everybody go be a teacher, why don't we find a different way to prepare students for the real world? You know, people like me are sort of textbook examples of this. I was an English and art history major. I did not go to J school, but now I'm a journalist. There's got to be some type of way, I think, for the governor and for really policymakers state and nationwide to think about training students or offering them training that gives them the chance to be more nimble You know, I know lots of folks who I went to school with who were also English majors or art history majors who are now program designers or are entrepreneurs. I mean, the way the economy works is a lot more fluid. And simply deciding that, you know, X plus Y equals Z in the economy is probably not going to yield the same results that you think it is.
Now, we've also had a lot of development news. The LSJ had an article, five projects to watch. And yeah, let's talk about some of these projects and I guess where they currently are. One of those being the Red Cedar Golf Course, which doesn't look like anything's going on.
Yeah, you know, this is a real puzzling development. You know, it's tremendous potential. I don't think anybody argues that this development doesn't need to be done. There's a real tremendous environmental need there. The Drain Commissioner, Pat Lindemann, has said, you know, for years this needs to be dealt with. We've got to find a way to clean up this river. And somewhere along the line, you know, the pipeline, as it were, of communication is breaking down. And this project that we were promised would go at, you know, quote-unquote lightning speed is not really going at lightning speed. It's sort of more just regular human speed right now. And, you know, I think that they had hoped to start really breaking ground and getting at least the drain commissioner's work done by now. And for some reason, it's not happening. And trying to get a straight answer out of anybody is just, well, this is the normal flow of business. And it's like, well, you set up these expectations with all of us by telling us, you know, it's going to go so quickly and it's going to transform everything. And right now it's not. But I think everyone in town is hopeful that, you know, we see some cranes in the air and some shovels in the ground soon.
Something
beyond overgrown golf course would be, you know, a real great addition to that corner of the city.
Mm-hmm. And they're looking at, that's going to be retail, housing, all that kind of stuff.
If it happens, you know, and we're even being told, well, you know, it's not that we've selected this plan, we're just looking at it. So there's a lot of nebulous fuzziness going on there that I think things are a lot less settled than we were led to believe initially, and maybe that's what we're seeing now.
Another project where it's kind of been stalled would be the casino. I don't know, is that ever going to happen?
Well, you know, I think the Sioux tribe believed that they had this legal provision that was going to basically give them carte blanche authority to open any off-reservation casino anywhere they wanted to. What they're finding is that so far the court is at least willing to hear the challenge of the state. And if that continues, if they cannot get the federal and the state government to agree that they do have this right, then no, it won't happen, and the Sioux tribe will be restricted to opening only casinos on their tribal lands. It's a kind of a big gamble. I mean, the developers told me initially that they were planning to spend at least $1 million before the legal challenges even started. So, you know, it's a fairly financially, you know, intensive risk to take, but they're willing to do it. If it does happen, you know, it'll be phenomenal. It'll be right downtown. It'll, you know, draw a lot more business to the Lansing Center. If it doesn't, then it's back to square one, and, you know, we'll find something else to do there, I suppose.
Now, there are some successes in development news. It's not all bad. The JW Knapp's department store, you can see that stuff is
right.
Going on there, which is exciting. And also the Heights of Eastwood, a couple of the restaurants have opened, but there has been some delays with the hotel that's supposed to go back there and other developments. What's holding things up over there?
That's unclear. The LSJ couldn't get comment out of the man in charge there, Mr. Hayward. But, you know, it could be any number of things. Either there's some financing trouble or perhaps there's some issue with, you know, construction. Who knows? You know, that development, the scary thing there, I think, for a lot of folks is that Lansing Township is the financier and developer there. So if these things don't start moving, then there's some real concern about taxpayers footing that bill.
Okay. Thanks, as always, Angela Rittrock of MLive. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after the news. This is Current State on WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. Michigan has made huge investments to develop alternative energy sources such as wind, solar, and biomass. But like the rest of the country, Michigan is still primarily fossil fuel-driven economy. Crude oil is big business in Michigan, especially in Jackson. In 2012, more than 1 million barrels were produced there, three times more than any other county. Oil drilling also extracts a brine that's mixed in with the petroleum. Right now, the saltwater waste product is shipped out of the drilling area by truck. One leading oil producer is asking the EPA for permission to bury the brine on site. That idea has many local residents concerned about the potential environmental effects on their community. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports.
In a state renowned for its water, the Irish Hills area is something unique. Just off US 12 near Brooklyn, locals in this tourist mecca have a saying here, 52 lakes in 15 minutes. On blustery days, whitecaps froth and slam against shorelines dotted with vacation cottages.
This is the greatest secret out. There's 50 lakes within an 8-mile radius of here. So it's just water. It's water, water everywhere.
John Bancroft retired here after a career teaching high school geography. About 3 years ago, he began to see something new on the landscape. Man-made steel digging for nature's buried treasure. Bancroft wanted to learn more. So he drew a homemade map and started doing his own digging.
A geographer looks at the impact that we have on the land, the relationship and the resources. You look at things thoroughly. And so I just started doing it. Make a map, find your location, and see what's happening at that location, and it just was natural.
What's happening in southern Michigan is a Texas-sized oil boom. In 2009, a large oil field was discovered here in what's called the Trenton Black River Formation. It's a naturally fractured zone of 450 million-year-old rock that yields more crude oil than any place else in the state. Jack pumps, some people call them horseheads, growl in mechanized chorus 24 hours a day. They penetrate the ground 4,000 feet or more, extracting oil, natural gas, and saltwater brine. The mixture flows through a network of pipes to one of a number of processing stations where the elements are separated in large tanks. Traverse City-based West Bay Exploration owns this facility. Tim Baker is vice president of engineering and operations. He says a strong safety regimen guides all phases of the process.
We actually pioneered this in the state, also with the groundwater monitoring wells. We also have vapor recovery systems on all the tanks so that there's no hydrocarbon gases that are vented to the atmosphere. That's why we try to keep a clean, clear environment so that if there's anything that happens, we see it.
There's a faint odor in the air, but not an offensive one. Baker says this oil comes from sweet wells. A sweet well contains no hydrogen sulfide, the pungent gas that's usually associated with rotten eggs. Until recently, West Bay used to burn off the excess gas through flaring. But with the resurgence of natural gas as a domestic fuel, the company is capturing the propane, butane, and methane to sell to regional gas lines. Tanker trucks are a constant presence in a processing station. Baker points to two trucks waiting to take on their payload. Two different products, two different destinations.
Yeah, the red truck is a 300-barrel tanker that's loading brine water to take to their Siler disposal well in Calhoun County. And then a white and green truck here to our right is loading propane and butane mix. And that actually is exported to Canada, I'm ashamed to admit.
Here's where the oil business gets a little sticky. As many as 40 tanker trucks a day travel the many roads that crisscross the Irish Hills. Residents aren't happy about the wear and tear, the noise, and the diesel fuel emissions. But mostly they're worried about something that hasn't happened yet. John Bancroft, the ex-geography teacher, is gazing out across the Raisin River. It's a particularly scenic vista. An ancient glacier carved out this marshland that grows thick with grass. It's a wildlife playground.
You can hear the red-winged blackbirds. The males are claiming their territory out here this time of year, waiting for the females. And there's a couple mallards there. There's all kinds of Canadian geese. We just saw a turtle. This piece of water right here is very clean. This is as good as you get, you know.
But about a year ago, a close call on this road nearly disrupted all that.
A brine truck rolled over on its side right there on the other side in the marsh, empty, on its way to be filled up. A little bit of diesel oil came out of its tank, and they put the booms in to mitigate that, and they cleaned it all up. And then they built this maybe mile and a half highway here, a beautiful road, because a lot of traffic comes up and down here, and that they couldn't have it on that dirt road without a disaster happen. And that's the fear.
That fear is on Tim Baker's mind, too. West Bay Exploration wants to avoid a spill, and it doesn't want to have to pay for so many trucks coming and going at all hours. The company would rather pump the brine back into the ground. It's asking the Environmental Protection Agency for a permit to build two injection wells in the area. An injection well is only about half as deep as a conventional drilling well, about 2,600 feet. West Bay Exploration believes it's a safe depth for disposal. The EPA is considering that application. Last year, when the issue first came up, the EPA held a public hearing. Many in the Irish Hills expressed their concerns about pollution. Among them was lifelong resident Tim Porter. He came away from the meeting less than satisfied.
One thing that did get under my skin a bit is we were told by West Bay that the waste would not stay here. The waste would be taken to already established and proven deep injection wells, and then all of a sudden they wanted to put two here. To me, that says a little bit about a company. You know, stick to your word, and I will, you know, do my best to take things objectively. And that did not set well with me.
Tim Baker asserts that if the disposal wells are dug in the area, they'll be built with multiple sealed layers to prevent the brine from leaching. Above all, he says, West Bay will not use a highly controversial method to force the brine underground.
We've done compatibility testing to make sure that the brine's compatible. We make sure that the brine is not injected at high pressures that would fracture the rock.
So you don't want to accidentally frack?
That's right. We don't want to frack. You definitely don't want to do that. You want to make sure you know where the fluid is going. And, you know, to that end, I think people think about their groundwater, their air quality. They think about the trucks, of course, and that's what we're after with the brine wells.
The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality would regulate West Bay's two brine wells, just as it does with more than 600 similar sites across the state. Field geologist Christy Shimko oversees that function in Jackson County. She says the brine would be stored far below the groundwater table, so there's no cause for alarm.
Most of the concerns you hear over the internet are just word of mouth. It's just misunderstanding that it's not occurring in Michigan. So we have a safe track record. This can be done feasibly, economically, and safe. So both sides can be mutually happy.
But happiness is a relative term, especially when economics and environmentalism collide. Some landowners in Irish Hills are leasing their property to the oil companies in exchange for their share of the royalties. Others are holding their ground on philosophical reasons. John Bancroft, the retired teacher, has seen this scenario before. He's taught it from books, and now he's watching it from his backyard.
This is a conflict, and it's always been in this country, okay? And it's how we manage it is important.
The EPA's public hearing on West Bay Exploration's injection well permit will be held Tuesday night at 6 at Columbia Center High School in Brooklyn. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
China's economic and political growth has been well documented. However, little attention has been paid to how rapid development is dramatically impacting cultural life in China. Organizations in both China and the U.S. are working together to preserve the country's heritage and build cultural ties. Kurt Dewhurst is a former president of the American Folklore Society, and he's the director of Arts and Cultural Initiatives at MSU. Under his leadership, the American Folklore Society started the China-U.S. Forum on Intangible Cultural Heritage. Early this week, Dewhurst described to me some of the changes facing China's culture.
I think many of us know about the economic changes going on in China, and certainly the changes that we think about politically that we read about in the news, but we certainly don't pay enough attention, I think, to the diverse cultural traditions of China and what's really happening not only to the tangible culture of China, meaning the historical buildings and cities and towns and how they're evolving, but this whole intensification of change and experience is having a dramatic impact on the cultural life of China. China has 55 ethnic minority groups, very deep and powerful, persistent cultural traditions that are being uprooted dramatically now by the movement of people, by the remaking of neighborhoods and cities, with the economic explosion that we're all witnessing in China today.
Now, you were president of the American Folklore Society when they started the China-U.S. Forum on Intangible Cultural Heritage. So explain a little bit about what this forum is and what the goals are with this forum.
It was a kind of a response, if you will, by the scholarly community of people who study intangible cultural heritage. And the American Folklore Society, much like the Chinese Folklore Society, have spent their professional time documenting and recording the living traditions of China, and making sure that they're not only documented, but they're preserved and archived and made available for future generations, but also taking steps to perpetuate them. So whether it's in festival formats or performances. And so for many people who work in that realm, they were seeing how rapidly these were all disappearing or coming under threat, because it wasn't just a matter of escalation of economics that changed things, but it literally meant relocation of people or occupations needing to go to work in other places. And so there was a real feeling that we ought to be taking some steps to, and maybe in a real dramatic way, to do the documentation and preservation and maybe making broader China aware of the depth and richness of cultural life in China and the creative life in China.
Why is it important that the U.S. is involved in that? That this is kind of a cross-cultural thing?
It is really an interesting kind of pairing, if you will. I think that part of this grew out of the fact that we have a number of scholars in the West and certainly in the United States who have had a long time interest in China. So they were aware of these changes and frankly, in some cases, alarmed by the changes. So they felt the sense of urgency. One of the things that the American Folklore Society was able to bring to this conversation, and we're learning from one another. It's not as if the U.S. is bringing new approaches that perhaps might not have emerged. We're learning from our Chinese colleagues too, but they're particularly interested in a lot of the digital and technological tools we're using to document, preserve, and digital repositories where you can record and make available and accessible to scholars around the world the traditions of China in ways that haven't been done. And so in future generations, this period of time that is a period of great change, we will save as much as we can so that we can look back and better understand it in the years ahead.
So what role is Michigan playing in this, and what role do you see MSU playing in building this cultural bridge?
Well, I think I think MSU can be a cultural bridge, and it's doing that in lots of ways. I mean, many of your listeners probably would know this already, but if not, they might be surprised to know that we have almost 4,000 Chinese students now at MSU. That's right, 4,000 students.
Yeah.
They're enriching the experience for all students at MSU. It's happened very very dramatically, really, for us. And so I think that we're learning about China through our Chinese students, but also we need to be able to find ways in which that all Americans can learn more about China. So some of the kinds of things that are going on right now are we're doing a variety of activities at MSU. We have an organization, a group on campus called the Cultural Engagement Council, which includes all the cultural units from the Broad Art Museum to the MSU Museum to art departments, the music college and Residential College of Arts and Humanities, the College of Arts and Letters, and others. We're all working together to have a whole year, thematic year, of looking at China. So there'll be lots of cultural experiences and programs, including an exhibition that we're working on that I'm a part of. We developed an exhibit, interestingly enough, first with support of the U.S. ambassador to China, and he wanted to have an exhibition of American quilts come to China because he was very interested in quilts and thought about them metaphorically as a kind of patchwork coming together as China is and America is. So the MSU Museum worked with Arts Midwest and South Arts in the United States to put together an exhibition. And this exhibition is touring 6 cities in China right now. It finishes up in Beijing at the new Chinese National Museum of Women and Families, which has just opened in 2010. Beautiful new museum. There's a book. The exhibit is called More Than the Sum of Its Parts. And as a result of that, the Chinese came back to us and said, well, we want to send to America an exhibition of Chinese quilts and textiles. So we're now working on that with the Michigan State University Museum has a partnership with the Yunnan Nationalities Museum, which is in Kunming, which is the capital city of Yunnan province.
Now, at the top, we talked about, we always talk about economics and diplomacy. Why is culture just an important thing to build a relationship on and to exchange, if not more important?
Yeah, I think one of the clear lessons is to say, it comes around the issue of I suppose one could say about diplomacy and more broadly defined, a lot of the struggles we're even having economically to find understanding come from the fact that we don't understand each other's culture and how we do business and how we communicate with each other. But I think it's even bigger than that. The last time I was in China, I was watching the national television network, the CCTV, mm-hmm. And they had a week-long series they were doing on what they called the crisis of creativity in China. And it was very interesting because it was almost the opposite of the dialogue we were having in the United States. In China, they're very proud of their success in science and technology and math and engineering, STEM. If mm-hmm. we're all hearing a lot about STEM in our schools and policies being driven that way. But they feel that they won't be able to compete is that they don't pay enough attention to creativity. And that grows out of an understanding of arts and culture and a deeper sense of what it means to be a creative thinker. And the kind of regimented way in which education is structured there is something they're trying to counter. So there's actually a pushback in China right now to encourage students to pursue the humanities and social sciences as careers, not just science, math, and engineering, all, mind you, very important fields in the 21st century. But they feel as though what they admire in the United States is we have found more balance in that way. And here we are moving more toward trying to be more like China, perhaps. So I think it's an interesting moment. We have a lot to learn from one another. And while we feel we might have a crisis in science and engineering here, China is trying to overcome what they perceive this crisis in creativity.
Well, I'm excited to see how this relationship and exchange plays out. Kurt, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
Kurt Dewhurst serves as the Director of Arts and Cultural Initiatives and is a Senior Fellow for University Outreach and Engagement. And he was the President of the American Folklore Society when they formed the China-U.S. Forum on Intangible Cultural Heritage. Thank you. This is Current State, and I'm Emmanuel Berry, and today I have the absolute pleasure of welcoming Al Martin to Current State. Starting today, Al is going to be taking over for the sports talk show. Welcome to Current State, and welcome to KAR.
Thank you so much, Emmanuel. I mean, this is unbelievable. I always tell people about this. I have some big shoes to fill with Earl Robinson leaving. Those aren't shoes, those are boots, but I'm ready to do it. I'm very excited to be a part of the WKAR team.
And we're excited to have you, of course. So tell me a little bit about how you got into sports. How did you end up going into sports journalism?
Well, with me, I mean, I've always been intrigued with sports. I mean, I've been a huge fan of it since I was since I popped out the womb, probably, to tell you the truth. But it started with my dad. When I was younger, I had a dream of playing basketball. I had the dream of going to the NBA. Reality hit me about in high school that I wasn't that great to go to the NBA. So I'm like, you know what? I still want to be a part of sports in some way. Became the sports editor of my school newspaper back in high school, the Cougar Crier. Shout out to them. They're probably not even listening right now. But once I started doing that, man, and interviewing the coaches and the different teams, I mean, I said, this is unbelievable. I love doing it. I'm a people person in general. So, I mean, going out and talking to these coaches around the schools, I said, why not pursue this in college? You know, and I would see guys like Stuart Scott on ESPN and Michael Wilbon, and I was like, this is what I want to do. Came to MSU, and that's all she wrote. So.
What are you've worked in the past for WLNS, you've done stuff with the Big Ten Network. What are some of your favorite moments in covering sports so far?
Wow, probably for me, I would have to say the biggest moment where I said, wow, I had to pinch myself, was probably when I covered the World Series this past year with the Tigers. Of course, they lost to the Giants. But, I mean, standing on the field and getting to, you know, talk to Jim Leland, and I'm talking to Jose Valverde and Prince Fielder, and then I'm seeing the World Series trophy go right by me. That was probably the coolest moment I've had as a sports journalist, and something I'll never forget.
What should we expect for sports talk? What are your plans?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, I always tell people when thinking about this show, I want it to go beyond the X's and O's. I don't want this to be your typical, hey, how did the Pistons lose, the 2-3 defense, the zone. Of course, we're going to talk about that because that's just the essence of sports in general. But at the same time, I want to go beyond that. I want to get to know, you know, feature-type stories, get to know the kids around the area who play high school sports. I want to, you know, dive into what coaches think about, you know, concussions or steroids, stuff like that. I mean, I want to go beyond, above and beyond your typical X's and O's sports talk.
Yeah, because sometimes I feel like people can get kind of alienated if they don't know all of that. They're interested in sports, but they want that human interest kind of aspect to it.
Exactly, Emmanuel. I mean, it's intimidating. I mean, if I'm talking to you about the 2-3 zone right now, you don't even know what a zone is.
I do know what a zone is.
Oh, do you? Okay, excuse me. There you go. Well, you did play basketball.
Okay, if you talk to me about football, then it falls apart.
Exactly.
I understand, like, there's two lines, and, yeah, they run into it. That's about it, but I got you on the zone anyway.
Right.
But what is your favorite thing to cover in sports?
I've been playing basketball since I was probably not even born, playing in the womb probably. But I love basketball. I love hoops. I love playing it. I love the NBA. College basketball, of course, is a thrilling sport. Basketball is my thing. But like I said, I love watching everything. I can watch anything and everything. So, but basketball is up there.
What do you think of Payne? Payne's going to stay.
I'm not even going to lie. I mean, it took him, forever to make his decision. And I'm sitting there. Usually when it takes, you know, a college athlete a long time to make a decision, it usually means that he's, you know, come to grips with moving on. You know what I mean? But it really shocked me when he came out and said it, but I wish him the best. I'm very excited he's staying. That makes my job more exciting, I'll tell you that.
Well, Al, I wish you the best of luck on your first day, and like I said, we're so thrilled to have you.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. I can't wait, guys.
Al Martin is the new host of Sports Talk. You can catch his first show today on WKAR AM 870.
That's right.
Coming up on Current State tomorrow, Mark Bayshore returns, so that's exciting. He's going to discuss why local food systems matter. Also, we look back at the most important headlines of the month, that and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and Yinsia Wong for production assistance. I'm Emmanuel Berry, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Thank you.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.